At the age of 5, she announced that she was going to be a paleontologist. And then, as she puts it, life got in the way. After a long and winding road, Mary Schweitzer eventually got there. And since receiving her PhD in biology from Montana State University in 1995, she, along with her mentor and colleague, Jack Horner, have turned the world of paleontology upside down, ushering in a whole new set of tools and a series of firsts. Dr. Schweitzer was the first scientist to identify the gender of a dinosaur, even showing that a T-Rex named Bob was actually a female and pregnant at the time of her demise. Dr. Schweitzer was also the first to identify and isolate soft tissue in an ancient fossil bone. Her work has ushered in the first real change in paleontology in the last 300 years. Her techniques are as groundbreaking as her presence and inspiration have been in smashing the glass ceiling for women in that field. Her influence has led to the developing field, or added to the developing field of paleoproteomics, where Dr. Schweitzer has also discovered that iron particles may play a part in the preservation of soft tissue over time. All in all, there's something about Mary. Currently, Dr. Schweitzer is a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at North Carolina State University and an associate researcher for the Museum of the Rockies, Montana State University, a research curator at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and a visiting professor in Loon. I am John Kirkwood, and welcome to Voices in the Wilderness. Christine and Dr. Schweitzer, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
If you don't mind, and if we could call you Mary, that would be
wonderful. Yeah, that's fine.
Mary, I want to start with a right now a legendary, I guess, initial meeting between you and Jack Horner. It was at a time in your life where you were going back, I think, to seek out possibly a certificate to teach science in high school, and you sat in on a lecture of Jack Horner's, and then afterwards you approached him and I'll let you fill in those blanks. But my question is, can you talk to us about that conversation and then go back in time, take us back in time a little bit and tell us what prompted your confidence there to challenge a premier paleontologist in the field about his beliefs?
Golly, that's a complicated question on many levels. So I was raised Catholic, and Catholics do not have a problem with an ancient earth and evolution. And I wasn't very science minded when I was a kid growing up. My brother is a doctor, spent his career as an oncologist, but I sort of got really deeply involved in the conservative movement of Christianity to the point where, 6,000-year-old earth and instantaneous creation and all of that stuff, which when I go back now and read the Bible, read the scriptures, it doesn't support that in my mind. But at the time I did, and I wanted to take a class from Jack because he was number one from Montana and number two, very well known in his field. And I have always loved dinosaurs since my brother got me addicted to them when I was 5-ish. So I went and sat down in his class. And after the first lecture, I introduced myself and I said, I'm going to teach you that you're wrong about evolution. And he said, I'm an atheist. Have a seat. And I did. And I guess that initial class made my God get so much bigger. He wasn't constrained by my expectations, and nor was he limited to my own interpretations of his holy words. So I know one thing about God, and that is that he does not and cannot mislead. And so the more I learned about the nature itself, how it operates, how it works at the molecular level, I had to really readjust what where I was coming from in that whole idea. And it's been an adventure ever since. And I learn more and more about God every day. And I feel incredibly blessed to have had this career and this calling.
So. Was there any crisis moment for you during that period? Or was the awe of what you were learning something, and your curiosity something that overcame any fear you might have had, or crisis of faith? Was there any of that involved?
There was never a crisis of faith, because I've always known that God exists and that he is who he says he is, and he did what he says he did. So it was just my own understanding. I wasn't going to throw God out because my understanding of how he did stuff was wrong. So I can't say that it was a crisis of faith, but it was pretty lonely for a while. All of my friends and pretty much everybody that I hung around with were, and many still are, young earth creationists. And having all of these ideas and not being able to talk about them to the people I was closest to was very lonely. So I guess there was that, but I just had to trust that God knew what he was doing. Seems that he did.
Is it hard for you when your friends and these people, they don't listen to you? They don't trust your knowledge and your understanding of something that you've studied?
You know, it's not my job to change anybody's heart. And if I try to change a heart or a mind, then I'm stepping into the role of God, because he's the only one who can convict a human heart. So I guess it would bother me if my identity was vested in that, but it isn't. And I love my friends. Regardless of how they feel about what I do, I make a lot of people really uncomfortable, and I know that, and I try to be very sensitive to that. But no, I'm never offended if somebody does not agree with me.
Have you been on the
other side? I get a little frustrated sometimes, but sorry. Yeah. But I'm not.
What about when your work is misrepresented, though?
That's painful. And that does happen a lot. Among the Christian community, the more fundamental branches of the Christian community, my work is misrepresented. But you know what? That's not my job. Just like anything else, it's God's job to justify, not mine. And so I'm perfectly content to leave that one in God's hands, and he can reveal what he wants when he wants, and he does not need me.
So, Mary, Christine and I deal with a lot of people who go through what you went through, you know, during that 6 months of meeting Jack Horner and then realizing that you held wrong beliefs about at least.
I wouldn't say wrong. I would say incomplete.
Okay. Incomplete beliefs. Many of the people we meet, they're going through, you know, the popular phrase is deconstruction. They've may not have lost their faith in God, as you have said was true of yourself, but they've definitely lost confidence in possibly their church or their spiritual leaders, and maybe even in the Bible, because it's been so ingrained in them that the Bible can only be read one way. And, you know, if evolution is true, then Christianity, you can't have both of them. They hear this not only from the new atheists like Richard Dawkins, but they hear this from some in the Christian community, like yes. Ken Ham and others. And mm-hmm. so that's one thing they take into it. And sometimes it does cost them their faith. I'm just wondering, since you were on the right end with Jack Horner, with somebody who was patient and so forth with you at that moment, have you had that experience as a professor? Have you had any students come to you maybe kind of upset that what they've learned in your class has challenged their spiritual foundations?
Yeah, I have actually. And working in a public institution, there's not a lot that I can say unless I'm directly asked outside of class. And that has happened. I had one student, and this is one of the greatest honors I've ever been given. I had one student come up about halfway through my introduction to dinosaurs class that I taught, and she said, "I just need to talk to you." She said, I feel like I have to make a choice between the faith I was raised in as a child and the science that I learning and love. And she said, "I heard a rumor that you're a Christian, so can you help me?" And I said, "Well, come on in and sit down." And she was in tears. She was deeply traumatized. And I just heard from her, and she said that she was so grateful, and that had a large part in renewing her faith. So what a huge honor. But I try really hard when I lecture to leave that door open and let students know indirectly that I'm always available to talk about that. And then, you know, whenever I'm on camera, which I try to avoid at all costs, I try to wear a cross or show some other thing where I can talk about who Jesus is to me without talking, without words, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Before we get too far into this interview, I would just like to get some clarity on exactly what was discovered, what has been discovered. I know your work is often misrepresented and claims are made about what you've discovered that wouldn't be the claims that you would make about what has been discovered. So when we're talking about soft tissues, like, is this the same as regular viable soft tissues in living animals, or are these remnants that are different from that? What's the state of these tissues and the condition that they're in, and did they become soft after they were prepped for analysis, or could tell us a little bit about these different discoveries that you've made and what, you know, clarify for us so we've got it correct.
So when I started graduate school, I was going to get a master's degree, and I had a little sort of self-contained project, which involved making thin sections of dinosaur bone. And I had a specific question I was going to ask in terms of load-bearing, the physics of bone, I guess. And I made a slide, and I was trying to learn a new technique. So I took it to one of the vet techs at the vet school here. And she was helping me. I had trouble with the bone tissue falling off the slides, and she helped me. And she took one of my slides to a conference, and she came back and called me into her lab and said, "You need to look at this slide." And so I had just defended my thesis idea the day before. And I went to her and I looked in the microscope and I saw these things that looked for all the world like red blood cells. Bone is very vascular. It has all kinds of canals that blood vessels run through. And you can study those and ask a lot of questions, but nobody had ever seen these little round red things. And they were not only just little and round and red, but they looked like they had a nucleus, each one. And that's important because the only vertebrates that don't have nucleated red blood cells are mammals. So if they were blood cells to be nucleated, would cement that they probably were from the dinosaur itself. And that is exactly where my research on those things stopped. I have not ever gone back to try to figure out what exactly they are because I had too many other questions. And I know what it would take to convince me, and I haven't, I just haven't had the opportunity. So somebody else can work on that. But when I got my PhD on that discovery, basically, these little round red things and all the other components of the bones. And then two things happened. We found a new dinosaur. My dear friend, Bob Harmon, who just recently died, found a new T-Rex. And I had just taken a job leaving my Montana to go to North Carolina. And so Jack shipped me out pieces of this new dinosaur, new T-Rex, and in a box, just a regular old box. And I had just set up my lab in North Carolina, and I talked to my technician. We opened the box together, and I said, oh my gosh, it is a girl, and it's pregnant. And she looked at me like, uh-huh, yeah. I think she thought I totally lost it. And it was just the most exciting time I can imagine. But in the process of trying to, you can't just say this is a girl dinosaur is pregnant. You have to, you know, back that up. And I looked in the literature for how scientists study this tissue. It's called medullary bone in modern birds, which are the only critters that have it. And so one of the things that they do is they remove the mineral to figure out things like the arrangement of collagen fibers in this medullary bone, which is very different than regular bone. And we set that experiment up, and I told my tech to let it, you know, don't let it go too far, because obviously if you dissolve all the bone, you won't have anything left. And it went a lot faster than she and I thought. And the next morning she came in and she said, you're not going to believe this. And the mineral taken away from that little piece of tissue left a spongy, stretchable, soft, and flexible remain. And I thought somebody was playing tricks on me, because everyone knows that can't happen. And the idea, you have to know a little bit about bone. Bone is a tissue that is a composite. It's part protein and it's part mineral. And obviously everyone knows, in quotation marks, that organics don't persist that long, so they're going to degrade. And so if you dissolve the mineral, you have nothing left, except that's not what happened. And so that was probably the next 3 months. Going into the lab every day was like Christmas. We saw more and more and more stuff, and tested and retested and did the chemistry and took microscopic videos. And it was consistent. It was repeatable. It was totally and completely not predicted. And it was really fun. That's all I can say. Science is a lot of fun.
And a lot of work.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of work, Christine said. Yeah. In an article, you were quoted as saying, finding soft tissues that responded to our tests like modern materials in many ways suggested that after 300 years of looking at this stuff, we don't know as much as we thought. It's also hard because, being a Christian evolutionary biologist, I receive a lot of mail that's not fun. Fellow Christians suspect my faith, and scientific colleagues suspect my science, but I have no agenda except to produce data. There's a lot there and a lot of questions that I want to explore there. You are a dynamic duo, but it's almost like a perfect storm. You have Jack Horner, who is dyslexic and thinks outside of the box and would take a hammer to, you know, an egg when no one else would, and you know, cut a T-Rex femur. And then you have you, a Christian who is a devout Christian, but also somebody who says, you know, when you go into your lab, you don't take your faith with you. Is that accurate?
It's accurate in that, you know, I tell my students when they start that there are some words that they're not allowed to use in their vocabulary. One of which is, I believe. One of which is never. You can't believe if you're being a scientist. We have no beliefs. We have only data. And data can do only a few things. It's very limited. Data can support an idea, data can disprove an idea, or data can fail to disprove an idea. Data do not prove. And if you are trying to prove something, you have an agenda and you are biased. So I always tell my students, you disprove your favorite hypothesis. That's the only way that you're going to be able to be straight up with your science. So that's kind of what we do.
So let me ask you about the use of your work, or you might say the misuse of your work. You have on the one side creationists who gravitate toward your findings and exploit them and misinterpret them or mischaracterize your findings. But then on the other side, you have the scientific community, which is meant to be skeptical. But I've read a number of accounts that said that the skepticism almost seems to be a cynicism. So I want you to answer both parts of that question. But when it comes to this response of fellow scientists, do you feel that any of that response, I know you haven't said this, but I've seen other paleontologists suggest the fact that you were a woman or that you were a devout Christian played to some of the skepticism toward your findings? How do you feel about that?
From the standpoint of my colleagues, I had a lot that would make anybody suspicious. I was known to be a young earth creationist, and I had erected a hypothesis that everyone thought was impossible. Everyone knows that organics don't persist. And so here I am. And I think it's justified. And I'm grateful, very grateful to my very harsh colleagues, because it made me a better scientist to constantly try to disprove my own ideas before they could. I am very confident that when we publish data, it will stand. And I've had a lot of people, like one colleague that says, oh, those blood vessels, you know, they're not anything. They're just biofilm. But there is no data to support that hypothesis. We've tested it over and over. And I guess the one thing that you have to look at it is, if you only had my work, these cells and vessels that we pull out of bone, that tells you two options. We're either wrong about how old the dinosaurs are, or we're wrong about how things preserve and degrade. Two alternatives, both testable. Now, the problem is we have 65 tons of evidence that the world is really old and none that the world is young. And so if you take, and I'm exaggerating with the 65 tons, but if you take the balance of that, the world is young and therefore the dinosaurs are young and it's not a surprise that soft tissues persist, or the world is old and the dinosaurs are old and it's shocking that soft tissues persist, but how? So the next question, which has set up my career, is if you're going to claim these are soft tissues and they come from a 65 million year old dinosaur, the next question is how? Why? How can we pull these things out? How come we've been studying dinosaurs in modern sense for 300 years and nobody else has seen them? And the answer is just nobody likes to dissolve their dinosaurs. They're not that common. So I had the great good fortune of working with Jack, who, as you noted previously, is not afraid to take a hammer to a dinosaur if there's something that can be learned from that. And that was just really important. So I think you have to look at all sides of the questions. And I think that to maintain that the world is 6,000, 10,000, whatever, there is absolutely no way you can explain the stuff that I see when I go out in the field, unless God is misleading. A lot of Christians say, well, God could make the planet look old. Yes, he could. He certainly could. He has every right to. He made it, after all. But why would he? What is the point to making something look different than all of our senses tell us is true? just for the heck of it because he can. God wants us to be, he wants us to know him. He doesn't want to put stumbling blocks in our path. And I think, you know, God doesn't mislead and he doesn't lie. And that doesn't give God credit when you say, oh, he could make it look old. Yeah, he could.
I wouldn't even say maybe that he can't, because that would be against his character.
Yeah, you have a point. It would be. Right. So the question is,
the glory of God, and mm-hmm. if his character is that of truthfulness, then it seems like to create in such a way that what's not displayed as truthful would not be consistent mm-hmm. with something that he could do.
Well, in the set,
but I don't want to overstep and try to make claims about God beyond. He's beyond what.
The second aspect of the trickster God is he's either deceitful or, in the modern age, he's incompetent. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just really not a great argument. In other words, he can't.
Well, and I think if you really look at Scripture and you look at some of the Psalms of David, he refers to a very, very ancient earth. You look at Job, who first book in the Bible just about, and he already says the world is more old than we could possibly fathom. And it's only been recently that there's been this chasm between an old and a young earth. It's mm-hmm. not present in most other cultures, just kind of ours.
Yeah.
So right. I just think we're making a huge issue out of something that shouldn't be an issue at all. God is God.
Yes, I do think there's kind of a parallel, though. When Big Bang cosmology was first presented, there were some in the scientific community who objected to it, basically because they knew that creationists would gravitate toward it and say, "See Genesis 1:1," and I have a suspicion that many in the scientific world probably rolled their eyes when you presented your information because of the same thing. They probably foresaw what was going to happen, that many would claim, well, see, we're wrong about dating the rock record. What was Jack's first response when you presented this information to Jack? How did he react?
Well, when I first went to him as a graduate student with those little round red things under the microscope, and by this time I was terrified of Jack. He can be very intimidating, and I was very insecure. And I sat there and gave him my scope or my microscope slides. He stuck it under the scope and he stared at it for at least, a month is what it felt like. Never said a word. And then he looked up at me and he was frowning and he looked angry and he said, "So, what do you think they are?" And I kind of hesitated and I said, "Well, they're in the right place. They're the right size. They're the right everything to be red blood cells, but everybody knows that's not possible. So I have no idea." And he said, "Mary, prove to me they're not." And that is one of the best things anyone has ever said to me, and it shaped my science, because again, if I'm trying to disprove my pet ideas, it removes bias. I'm trying really hard to disprove that those things are red blood cells. So about, maybe 5 years later, I called Jack up and I said, "Jack, we have a pregnant female dinosaur." And that was a little easier because it had always been proposed that dinosaurs probably had this tissue that's known to be present in birds. So he was pretty excited about that and immediately sent me more dinosaurs.
Can I ask a question just real quick about pregnant dinosaurs? Mm-hmm. Because in my very engineering brain that's not very biology focused, I don't think of birds or dinosaurs as being pregnant. I think they have of them as laying eggs.
Yes,
but you're right. To make eggs. So could you just, help me understand what it means?
Yeah, I use pregnant because everybody knows what pregnant means. But what I mean truly is that the dinosaur was in lay, just like a bird is in lay. If a bird is producing eggs, we say they're in lay, not pregnant, because they don't have a uterus, sort of. Well, they actually kind of do. But
that helped me.
But it's just easier. It's shorthand for saying Yeah. So
perfect.
Well, you made another comment that I'd like to focus on a little bit, because theology used to be known as the queen of the sciences. It really is fallen in the recent years. But you just made a statement. I've heard you made it before, Doctor. You made the statement that if you try and prove or disprove your hypothesis, you remove bias. Can you explain that a little bit more? And can you contrast that with what people try to do in apologetics, which seems to lack that kind of self-policing of the scientific method?
I don't know if I can do that, but I can try. Hmm. So if I set out to prove that my dinosaurs in lay were pregnant, I can pull all kinds of evidence together that supports that. But all the evidence that doesn't support that, I ignore. Hmm. I don't have to bring that to bear. If I am trying to disprove that, I seek out evidence that would shut down that theory. If there's not, or if I can't explain it. So, for example, we found osteocytes, which are bone-forming cells. Everybody that has bone has osteocytes. They're a very specialized type of cell. They look different. They have different chemistry. They're located differently in everything from a fish to a human. So if those are not osteocytes, what the heck else could they be? Could they be biofilm? Well, let's disprove that. How can we test whether it's biofilm or not? Could they be some kind of fungal spore that invaded the bone? Could they be? And so I throw out all these hypotheses. I test each one and I can knock each one out of the park, leaving only standing those things are osteocytes. That's a lot better than trying to prove osteocytes and not look at the fact that it could be biofilm or fungi or anything else because you don't want to see it. And I know that scientists all think they're not biased, but we all are. We all have our biases. We all have our prejudices. And I think that one of the gifts of science is being able to be more honest in our inquiries by looking at all of the options and knocking them out one by one by one with data. So,
for example, the flood,
mm-hmm. Noah's flood. Was it a worldwide flood? Did it happen? How can I test that? Well, if I go back in time, geologically speaking, I can show you floods. In the sedimentary record, I can see a flood. I know exactly what it looks like. I can even, well, not me, but my colleagues can tell you how fast the river was flowing or how fast the water was rising, how long it stayed there, when it receded. We see that through the rocks. So I think there is no evidence of a worldwide, the whole earth being covered in water all at one time. No evidence ever. In any of the rocks that we have, do we have rocks that say the whole world was underwater at one time? So how can you make that jive with the Bible? Well, you know what? It says in the Bible that the whole world came to hear Jesus speak, or Paul speak, one of the two. Well, did they? Because I'll tell you, the Native Americans living in Montana at the time Jesus walked this earth were not there in that audience. So what does the Bible mean when it says the whole earth was underwater, or the whole earth came to hear? There's lots of room for alternative interpretations that don't affect the science. And I think that we as Christians need to give God room to be God. He knows what he's doing.
You've said previously, you said if you have all this evidence and proof positive that God exists, you don't need faith. I think he kind of designed it so that we'd never be able to prove his existence. And I think that's really cool. That is kind of in contrast with modern apologetics that does think they can prove God and prove the worldwide flood and other things. Do you think Christians would be wise to take a page out of the scientific method and do what you just said with stuff like the flood and other things. Are we removing the very nature of faith when we think we can come up with a formula to prove God?
I think so, but to say the Christian community should do this, I mean, I think when Paul is talking about the people who are weak in faith, honor them and let them keep their days of observance of holy days and all the other stuff, recognize that not everyone is on the same page with their faith or with their science for that matter. I don't think we should force feed anybody. God's job is to bring them where he wants to see. But I think we need more honest inquiry. And I think, I mean, there's everything from, someday I'm going to write a book. There's everything from the origin of the earth, the solar system, the universe, all the way to the origin of humans that we can test, we can measure, and we can look at, okay, it says in the Bible that God made man. Of course he made man, but what does it mean to be human? Mm. You can't really define a human. Even though we have lots of them to work with, do you define a human by somebody who has 46 chromosomes? What do you do with a Down syndrome? Are they not human? It's really hard to find a definition, and the closer it is to us, the harder it is because our ego's on the line. So give God room to be God. He knows what we are as humans. He defined us. And I think that we need to, as I've said to some parents who've talked to me, we need to learn what the scientific community says and why they say it about these key issues. So if nothing else, we can give our children a way to hold on to their faith when they get to college. Mm-hmm. That's important. It's not important how old the earth is. It's not important this, that, or the other thing about scripture. What's important is that your faith is not shakable by every new scientific discovery. And that's the best gift you can give your children as Christian parents, I think. Don't make them afraid of science.
Yeah. So one of our former guests that we had on our show wrote a book called Baby Dinosaurs on the Ark, The Trouble of Getting It All to Fit. And excellent book, Janet Ray Kellogg. Janet Kellogg Ray, sorry. And one of her comments was about the high cost of young earth creationism.
It is.
In that when people discover that the information that they were given and has been tied so very closely to the gospel, and when they discover it's wrong, like your student that you mentioned earlier, that so many times they have this crisis of faith, or they lose trust in either the Bible or the church leadership or the church teaching, or even sometimes in Christ. What kind of advice do you have for youth pastors and parents, and not even just youth pastors, regular pastors, if they're going to touch on science and faith in their churches, or talk with students or adults even, so that we don't have this high cost of a faith crisis with when incorrect information is presented?
I think Andy Stanley actually did this pretty well when he said in one of his sermons, no Christian should ever be afraid of science or all that it has to reveal. When science presents something that is new and seems to contradict faith, your first response should be, huh, so that's how God did it. And I love that, because scientists cannot say there is no God, and they cannot say anything about how or why. And so again, give God room to be God. He did it. He knows how he did it. And if he thought it was important for us to know, he'd reveal it. Just like he has many, many other things, the power of the atom, for example. But it all comes in due time. But the focus should be on him, not on what science says about it. Because science can't address it. Science is extremely limited as to the questions it can ask, and God isn't one of them. And I had one colleague who was a profound atheist who is driven nuts by Christians. And he says, Mary, I made it the focus of my career to try to disprove God, and I can't. And it drives me crazy. But there again, he's not trying to prove anything. He's trying to disprove, and that's science.
Right. So you've mentioned a couple times just that these topics shouldn't matter. It doesn't really matter how old the Earth is or if God used evolution or some other way. And I agree with that to the extent that God is God and it was his decision to create however and whenever he wanted. But I would also say he gave evidence of what he did do. So in a way it matters in the fact that truth is important. So
yes,
we shouldn't
I agree with that.
Untruthful. So why do many Christians, do you think, resist the idea of an old earth and evolution when these really shouldn't matter any more than, you know, we've gotten past the idea that the earth is stationary and doesn't move and is fixed on its foundation. And we all accept that really the earth does move and orbits the sun. And
it took a few hundred years for some of us, though.
Yeah.
Christine.
Well, okay. Well, there are less of them. But why do so many Christians resist these ideas?
I think it's fear. It's fundamentally that if I give one inch, if there's one sentence in the Bible that is not literal, the whole thing falls apart. And so to allow the fact that God did something in a manner that we wouldn't predict, or to give credence to the nuances of the Bible, is very frightening. Because think about all there is to lose. And so I think I've always said that young earth creationists show, weak faith and a weak God, not letting God be the one who leads those investigations and allowing God to say what he did. Weak faith, because I'll tell you one thing. If I talk to young earth creationists and I say, suppose I have 100% indisputable evidence that the world is 4.6 billion years old, what would that do to your faith? If you give me 100% undeniable evidence that the world is 6,000 years old, it's not going to change my God at all. And you have to think in terms of why you're fearful of anything new that science can tell us. Now, there are some things science can tell us that should be frightening. But the minute you take God out of the equation, all things are. And that's where we're at right now. Science negates God. It excludes God. And I don't think that that is necessary, and I don't think that it's right.
Yeah, it just seems like it's setting people up for a faith crisis to tell them that they must choose between science and young earth creationism.
Well, and I think it's a great way to lose your teenagers.
Oh, yeah.
Is it also a barrier for Christian kids going into the STEM field?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think absolutely it is a barrier.
Yeah.
I have students who start out with faith and they live this dual life. They can compartmentalize the science that they do and still hang on to a young earth creationist viewpoint. And that's fine. And, you know, the thing of it is, as a scientist, I know that I can always be wrong and that somebody can come out with new data and disprove my entire career tomorrow. And that's kind of a scary thing to think about. And so maybe that's a good way to compartmentalize, is saying, I'm going to do the best science I know how to do with the tools that I have at hand and state what it means. And somebody can come along and prove me wrong, including how old the world is, if that would be the case someday. It hasn't been so far. And there's a lot of people who have actively tried to disprove that.
Right. Yeah, I think it's more, I mean, isn't it more complex than that, just because it has to, whatever kind of hypothesis or you develop has to account for all of the information. And
yes,
once you have so much information, it is more difficult to find a single piece to overturn it all.
Yes.
So the areas to me that seem most likely to have big shifts are those areas where the data is limited, or we don't have a very full understanding, which is of course right where you're working in understanding mm-hmm. fossilization and these tissues, because this is a newer area of inquiry. It's also like quantum gravity areas. Those are that's not well understood and ripe for a seismic shift once that's just figured out.
Yeah.
Abiogenesis, I think, is another area where there's mm-hmm. still a lot of work to be done.
Origin of life question. Right. I mean, God is the God of life. He did it. So what do you do with life on Mars? Is right. that going to look like our life, or does that make it less life, or who defines life in the first place? You know, you gotta think about stuff like that. And you're right. We find an organism on Mars, it's going to shake everything up once again, mm-hmm. which I think God kind of chuckles at, because I don't think he wants us to be too comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So do you think someday we'll find and recover like DNA from dinosaurs?
Well, as I tell my students, never say never. I think that it's maybe a bit more likely now that we have next-gen sequencing and all of the tech tools and technology, the algorithms that look at any kind of data. It's a very, very different prospect than when I started graduate school. But to me, as I've always said, I think DNA is kind of boring. It's proteins that are where everything's at. We know that they last longer than DNA. We know that they are the expression of DNA, but it is proteins that natural selection acts upon, not DNA. And so those are shaped by the forces of natural selection. And I think they have a whole lot more information, but then I am biased. I admit that freely. So I'm like, why would anybody waste their time on DNA? Don't quote me on that. But, you know, you never know. And my colleagues who work in DNA, I think, would find it enormously fruitful if we could get dinosaur DNA. For me, the question is not so much, you know, we'll never clone a dinosaur, I don't think. That's the never I used. But what can it tell us about the molecule? The evolution of DNA. The chemical composition of DNA that allows it to preserve. What can we use? I mean, think about it. You got a polymer that contains information that's hung out for 65 million years. What can we do with that if we ever got there in the first place? So there's a lot of questions we can ask if we could get DNA from a very old dinosaur.
And isn't it great that we have people with different interests so we can continue to learn on multiple fronts?
Yes.
So,
absolutely.
So the T-Rex, some of these dinosaurs that you've been investigating have been on the younger side of the reign of the dinosaurs. Yes. How far back are you seeing these soft tissue remnants? Right.
80 million, right? Or is it more?
80, 90 million.
Well, From a molecular standpoint, we can go as back as far as the Jurassic. My colleague Johan Lindgren from Sweden, who I work with very often, came out with a paper a couple of years ago on an ichthyosaur that preserved all kinds of molecules, pigment molecules, fat molecules, lipids, protein structures, and that was Jurassic. And then along with Panyan Hong from China, who came to our lab and worked with us, we were able to show the presence of feather keratin in a dinosaur 5 million years older than the oldest bird. So Jurassic feathers on Jurassic Ancyornis, 5 million years older than Archaeopteryx, that still had enough protein preserved, sequence data, that we could tell that they had the mutations that allow feathers to be feathers and not skin or scales. So that was pretty cool.
That is really cool.
I know that you like to go back, Doctor. Your colleague, yes. Jack, thinks that we could go forward with like a dino chicken. Do you have any interest in that area of trying to bring a modern dinosaur to life through something like a chicken?
No.
Or do you think that's a dead end?
I don't have any interest in it, even if I thought it were possible, but why? I don't agree with hubris.
Mm.
And I think when we try to mess with stuff like that, just because we can do it, what are you going to do with such a creature? It's kind of like
make
the de-extinction movement. What, make a movie? Yeah, then what? But the de-extinction movement, you have to ask questions like, we know that it takes about 5,000, I think is the number that was quoted, genetically distinct individuals to maintain a sustainable population.
Mm.
If you clone one, where are you going to get the rest? So what's this guy going to do? He's going to die of loneliness and be an old maid living out his life in a zoo just because we wanted to show we could do it?
Mm-hmm.
That's wrong. Mm. Now, if you have a definitive question, maybe you could make the case for recovering molecules that might answer that question. But why engineer a dino chicken? What questions would you possibly want to answer with a dinosaur chicken? Maybe you could ask questions about how evolution progressed, but a dinosaur chicken, the way that Jack talked about it, is not really re-engineering a dinosaur. It's making some kind of a hybrid.
Mm.
So what are your questions and why?
Mm.
And I think that that's, you know, I mean, we talk about the young earth creationist community and what they have to give, but I think that's what the scientific community has to give. What are your questions and how can you justify what you're doing? And that one, I don't think has been justified at all
for the long-term benefits. Your background in biology kind of gave you a leg up in paleontology, because most people at the time were coming from geological backgrounds. Is that right?
Yes.
Is that changing?
That's true.
Because of...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think the first vertebrate paleontology meeting that I went to that dealt with dinosaurs, that fraction of it, I think there was like four women. And now women outnumber men, in particular in the student community, in terms of those going forward in dinosaur paleontology. So it's a sea change.
Exciting.
It is exciting. And it's happened in my one lifetime. But I think that really interesting thing to me is seeing how the questions have changed in paleontology because of the influence of women. We ask different questions and we approach it different. And I think that's... can only make the discipline stronger. You need both.
Absolutely. So I assume this work that you're doing is also being applied, you know, not just to dinosaurs, but other fossils and other time periods.
Yeah, I think so. Mostly younger time periods.
What are some of the hopes that you think will materialize in terms of the different discoveries that might be just around the bend, or the kind of the key information that you're hoping that you can hone in on by falsifying other hypotheses that aren't that information. Does that make sense?
Well, I think my questions are, so we can pull 65 to 80 million year old molecules out of the rock record. So what? Why should I care? And again, what's the practical implications of it? And for me, a lot of the questions that I have come from looking at modern problems. So for example, we know that iron is involved in Alzheimer's disease progression, where usually people with Alzheimer's have higher iron levels in their brain. We know that iron is highly reactive and that it causes cross-linking of proteins whenever it's let loose, which can get me off on another tangent. But if we can understand happy, healthy blood vessels and 80 million year old blood vessels and the pathway that it's taken to get from one to the other, maybe we can figure out how to reverse that pathway at key points and offset the damage iron does to tissues. So that's kind of one thing. Why blood vessels persist in bone and still retain their original resilience and transparency? Maybe it's because those proteins that make up the blood vessels have a very strong affinity for mineral. And we know atherosclerotic plaque in human hearts is basically bone depositing on the inside of blood vessels. So what if looking at how blood vessels persist in dinosaur bone can show how we might mitigate the deposition of bone on the inside of blood vessels leading to blockage? You got to kind of think outside the box, but I kind of think that God gave us everything we need to solve all of our problems. Another thing would be, can we, if we ever could get DNA out of dinosaurs, could we see genetically how they had adapted to their high CO2 environment? Because that's a molecular question. And if we are going to high global CO2 levels, maybe we could learn something from the dinosaurs. Maybe it's a tweak in their molecules, a change in their genetic structure that made them not only healthy, but thriving in a CO2 world that would kill us. They did it. The data are already there waiting for us to just gather them and interpret it. So I think the questions that I think about when I can't sleep at night are far beyond dinosaurs. I think dinosaurs are cool and that's what got me started, but I think the implications go far beyond our reach that way. So that's my hope anyway.
What do you say, doctor, to colleagues who are surprised you're a woman of faith? You mentioned that the atheist colleague that said to you he's spent his life trying to disprove God and he can't. What is your response when they ask you why, or they're surprised? Or is that not your experience? Are people maybe not as interested in that in your field?
You know, I don't know that any of my colleagues have ever asked me about my faith. I think they all know I'm a Christian. They know where I stand because it's out there and in just about anything about me you read on the internet. I don't hide my faith. I will talk about my Jesus every chance I get if anybody asks me. But if they don't ask me, I'm not going to make them uncomfortable. I'm not going to shove my Jesus down their throat. So I think they're just kind of like keeping me at arm's length because I think I'm a little scary, but I don't know that for sure. No, it hasn't ever come up. Comes up a lot the other way around though.
The other way around with people of faith questioning your faith.
Yes.
You famously said at one point, one other thing I might say is that I've gotten a lot of pretty cruel, harsh, judgmental emails over the years. And if you're a Christian saying things like that, it's no wonder my colleagues don't want anything to do with faith. Christianity is about love, and these are not really loving responses to anything. Is there a solution for this? I mean, I know it's you're probably going to say Jesus is, right? But it seems to be getting worse almost. I mean, mm-hmm. through the COVID crisis, and it seems like the extremes on the plate are moving centrifugally to the outside. And I know as a Christian you have hope, but maybe you could share it with us to give us some.
Well,
kind of
I think that Jesus came to destroy fear. Mm. And I think that when people are fearful, when they are confronted with things that make them uncomfortable, they get angry. And that's a very human response. But they forget. We all forget when we're threatened or when we're confronted. We all forget that Jesus calls us to love one another. If there is love, there is dialogue, not judgment. Mm-hmm. And I think that coming at it, talking to parents who know I'm an evolutionary biologist, if your child has a scientific aptitude and you insist the world is 6,000 years old, you're not preparing them to fight the arguments that they're going to get thrown at them. And you're giving them a reason to give up on faith. Learn the arguments. Learn the data. Why scientists say what they say. Why do scientists have no problem with evolution? Why do scientists find that that is the grand unifying theory of all biology? Why do scientists fully accept that the world is 4.6 billion years old? That's what the data say. And when I teach my introduction to dinosaurs class, that's what I say. You ask me why. Every single time I say something that you don't understand, you ask me why. Because if I can't answer your question, I'm in the wrong field.
So someone's watching our podcast and they don't know the why. They don't understand why scientists think there's evidence for evolution. They've been told their whole life that there isn't any. What resources would you recommend? Where can people go to learn more about evolution or the age of the Earth, and preferably from a source that's not going to pound on them that they can't be a Christian and understand the topics?
I think that BioLogos and the American Scientific Affiliation are two really, really good resources. We wrote a book, so they can, if they want to know why we say what we say about dinosaurs, that's how I teach my class. Why do we say? How does radiometric dating work? What's the underlying theory behind it so that you can say when we've got this data, it means this? But I think there's a ton of resources on the BioLogos website, and I think it's presented very well. So that would be where I would start. And then, you know, I don't think Christian parents should be afraid to ask people. Write to Jack. He may not answer you because he doesn't answer his emails very often, but there are a lot of my colleagues that do. Ask them. And not in a threatening way, because what we often get is Christians will come to a field site where we're all working like crazy and say, "You're going to go to hell because you believe this is old." And that is not loving. It is putting yourself in the place of God because you're judging, and it's not right. You don't know where they're going to go. That's for God to determine. So
nothing in the Bible that says you must believe in a 6,000 year old world or that dinosaurs and people coexisted in order to go to heaven or in order to be saved or redeemed.
Well, and I think we've lost sight of exactly that.
Faith away from Jesus.
Yes. We've lost sight of that because there is only one criterion to get us into heaven, and that's that we embrace Jesus and what he did for us. And the rest of it is, and that's, you know, I mean, it's not something I'm going to go to the death, fight the death for. God knows whether evolution is the tool that he used to bring about diversity. I think it is. I think the data support that. But hey, if I'm wrong, I'm going to go to heaven anyway because Jesus did that for me. So that's the rest of it's just dialogue. And we've forgotten how to dialogue in this country, which breaks my heart.
Oh, on so many subjects. That's unfortunate too. So much division and polarization. Yeah.
I already know the first part of this answer. Would you rather be in the field or in the lab? But would you rather be in the classroom than in the field? Do you like teaching even more than research? Where do you land on that, Doctor?
Oh, gosh, that's not fair. I like it all. I love being out in the field. It reminds me why I do what I do. It's magic, especially being out in the field here in Montana, which is my home. I'm a fourth generation Montanan, but I love the wide open spaces, being able to find a little teeny tiny flower in the driest of dry country, just resistant to all of that. My eyes might be the first to ever lay eyes on a bone from an ancient source. I love the field. But I love the lab, except my tech is way better at it than I am. So I just basically sit down and she brings me data. I love her. She is a gift from God. And I love to teach. And I am a completely pathological introvert. I'm scared of people. It's the hardest thing that I ever do to go into a large group of people I don't know and try to insert myself. And that's why I don't go to meetings very often. It's just really terrifying. But I believe in my students. I believe that they're hungry to know, and we don't challenge them enough. They never leave my class feeling like they haven't been challenged. And I feel pretty good about that. But they want, and I told them, I said, how can you fight to protect this planet if you don't understand it? You can't love what you don't know. Learn. And, you know, I teach by asking questions. And since I'm not very smart and I've been on the other side of the desk, I know which questions to ask. And they're like, I never thought about it that way. And pretty soon they'll come back and they'll go, you know, it's like 2 weeks ago when you said this. Yeah. And we have to make them think or we're lost. We're lost and we can't be afraid.
And we just love to see that attitude in the church too, because the heavens declare the glory of God. And I think that terminology means the whole universe, not just the sky, but all of the life and all of the oceans, the ground, the trees, the animals, it all testifies to God. And if we love him, we ought to be interested in seeing his glory and studying it.
Absolutely.
And I know people have different passions and that's really good, but no Christian should turn their nose up at studying what God has made it if we love him.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. And
I think fear, just looking fear at how God reveals himself in the creation that he made, he wants to be known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's amazing.
Community is so wrapped up in fear, as you said before, and fear, fear and curiosity don't really go together well. It's seen as an enemy.
Well, I know the American Scientific Affiliation, ASA, is having their annual conference, their annual meeting coming up in, I think about 6 weeks at the end of July. Do you ever go to the ASA conferences?
I think I was at one of the first ones, but yeah, I don't go unless I'm invited.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, I know one of the speakers this year is Nobel laureate and optical physicist, Dr. Donna Strickland. And I'm hoping maybe we can have her on our show someday too. It would be fun to hear what she has to say, but, we just really appreciate having you join us today and your time. And I know your schedule is so busy and you're out working in the field these days. So thank you so much for setting aside some time for us and answering our questions. We did a little bit of crowdsourcing on social media to see what people wanted us to ask you. And I can't tell you how many people were just like, well, make sure to let her know how much we appreciate her and make sure to let her know we love her work. And we feel bad that your work has been misrepresented. And pass on our love. So I just want to let you know we really do have a big fan base, and we're very thankful that you took some time to talk to us. And
God's bigger than anything anybody would want to say, so he can defend me when I don't want to, and I rest on that.
And it's been a delight, and I just want to say that my daughter and both my daughter and I are big fans, and so it's been a real pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.